Hello and welcome back, my fellow negatively biased hairless monkeys. That's not an insult, just a fact. Keep listening and you'll see what I mean. This is a conversation about getting a positive perspective on challenging situations and negative emotions and hard conversations. You know, the stuff that you deal with every day. I'm joined by Dr. Rebecca Farris to talk, amongst other things, about positive psychology, what real mindfulness looks like and why it's essential in the work that we do, about finding and living our strengths, and having those hard conversations that we mentioned before. Rebecca's career journey has taken her from cattle vet legend, complete with her Australia-New Zealand College of Vet Surgeons memberships in dairy medicine, to a mentorship and teaching role at Melbourne University, and currently spending time on the dark side, with part-time smallies emergency work. In 2016, Beck's curiosity and a desire to become a better vet led her on a journey of learning how to become a better human. In 2019, she graduated with a professional certificate in applied positive psychology and immediately put her new knowledge to work as an educator, teaching local school communities how to be more resilient. These days, Beck is using what she's learned to help make the vet profession better through her well-being consultancy, Flourish Ed, which provides positive, playful, and targeted well-being education for organizations who want to create environments where their people can flourish. Now, if you've been paying attention, you'll see a pattern in our last few episodes in that the guests have something in common. Yes, they're all speaking at the Vet Expo in Sydney on 26 and 27 October. And this matters because we'll be at the Vet Expo with our very own Vet Vault stall that will be turning into a portable podcasting studio. Just this week, I bought a chunky hardshell suitcase on Facebook Marketplace so I can safely transport my desktop and my recording gear. And I bought a fancy new mic, which we'll be using to harass the speakers at the conference to dive deep with us on their passions with some live podcasting. So this is why I've been stalking the speaker list to see who we should interview at the event and bumping into this whole new network of wonderful people and their wonderful ideas. But I get a bit excited and I'm not that good at waiting. So I've been jumping the gun and getting a few of them on the podcast to explore their ideas right here with you. We would love you to come and hang out with us and all these beautiful minds that will be speaking at and attending the event. And if you don't know what the Vet Expo is, it's an event that will bring the veterinary, animal health, and pet care worlds together with over 100 major vet and pet product suppliers, as well as some of the most innovative startup companies in the vet space in attendance. So once you've explored the expo floor to see what's new and exciting in Vetland, and you've gorged yourself on the very long list of presentations, come and find us across the aisle from the coffee shop. Say hi, have a chat. In fact, I have a challenge for you. Come and interview us. Grab the mic, be the podcaster that you know you are at heart, and ask myself and Gerardo anything you want. We'll put it out live, so no editing out of any of our answers or our blunders. To make sure we have a total Vet Vault listener takeover at the event, we have a special offer for you from the team at the Vet Expo. Use VetVault70, that's all caps, VETVAULT 70, when you check out, and your tickets for the 2 days will be $90 or $105 if you want to join on the boat cruise. Did I mention that there's a boat cruise? There's a boat cruise. That is 70% off the standard pricing. We would love to see you there. Okay, let's get back to Dr. Rebecca Farris. Welcome to the Vet Vault.
Thanks, Hugh. Thank you for having me.
Just chatting beforehand, we actually have quite a similar career trajectory and similar things that we are hoping to achieve.
Yeah, it sounds like you're a few steps ahead of the game for me.
Don't know about that. That dangerous thing of comparing to others. There's a quote that I like and that I often have to look at for myself, because I fall into that trap of comparing to others the whole time, of going, well, look at them. Why do I suck so much? This person's so far ahead of me. It's the gap theory in happiness research. I don't know if you've heard of it. So it's basically, there's a gap between what we have and what we want. And it's that gap that causes unhappiness. There's the gap between the life you live now and the life you want to live. And that's where the conflict happens. And there's two strategies to fix that. It's either you work harder to get that thing that you want, to go, well, these are the steps I need to do to get there, or I need to learn to want what I have. And then the second strategy, and I think for me it's a combination of the two, but the strategy for achieving that second one is to stop looking at others. They say you've got to pick an anchor. What are you anchoring what you want in life to? Is it your own values and your own desires, or is it what somebody else is doing? Philosophy straight off the bat there.
Well, It's interesting because, like, as soon as you started saying that, I could look over to this affirmation card I have over here that says, don't berate yourself for being preoccupied with your professional future. Don't let others describe the anxiety as neurotic. Give the agony the time it needs. Luxuriate in it and prepare to spend 1 hour every evening and 4 hours every weekend. Is that how we spend the gap?
I think so. I like that. What is it? Say the sentence again about allow the agony, or what's that?
Give the agony the time it needs. Luxuriate in it.
That's my problem. I try and get away from that agony as much
That's interesting. Isn't it like we try to lean away from these uncomfortable feelings when perhaps we should be leaning into them? They're normally telling us something, aren't they?
Wow. Should we just jump straight into that? Do you want to expand on this? It's straight into the deep end.
Yeah, we have, haven't we? Actually, it's really interesting because we're talking on the Vet Bolt because we're coming up to the Vet Expo and want to talk about why we should make time for positive emotions, but we've jumped straight in with the negative ones. But what you said there about one option is to want what we already have, and I guess that's the point of deliberately making time for the positive emotions so we can start to appreciate what we have. So when we have a negative emotion, we tend to want to move away from that thing, that feeling. And whereas a positive emotion helps us be a bit more open-minded and broaden our thinking. So maybe when we have those uncomfortable moments, the antidote is to find something positive so that we can start to be creative and start to think about what it is that we want. What is that? How do we move through that gap? Does that make any sense?
It does. Give me an example though, so I can get my head around it. So let's say you run up into, I'm trying to think of a common negative emotion. We're talking to vets, so let's try and think of a vet situation of a negative emotion.
Panic.
Yeah, panic. Okay. That's a common one.
Yeah, you're talking about your background in emergency. I think there's probably a fair bit of panic that comes into emergency. And I guess, you know, the classic option would be to think about mindfulness and using some breathing strategies to lower our cortisol and come back down so we can start to think about what are we looking at and what do we need to do next. The panic, I think, is telling us that this is important to us. I guess if we didn't care what happened to the animal, we wouldn't be so panicked about what to do and whether we can fix it. I don't think it's a bad emotion. It just, we need to, in the moment, it may not be that helpful to run away. So you might use a strategy like mindfulness in the moment to feel calmer, but then you might need to think of another strategy later on to explore, why did I feel panicked? What can I do to overcome that next time? And is it that I need to do some more learning or something like that? Whereas if we just stick with that feeling of panic, then we may say that, oh, this isn't right for me. Is it? Oh, I'm in the wrong job. I can't do this. I'm panicked. Now,
are you reading my mind?
No, I'm reading my own mind. And I preface this with, I am the classic do as I say, not as I do, because I guess that's probably where I sit at the moment. I do some casual emergency work and it does often fill me with panic. And I know it means that I need to learn and do some more. And we talked before about time and where do you find the time? There's so much information out there. There's so much we can learn. Where do you start these days? It's almost like information overload.
Well, you start by subscribing to the Vet Bolt Clinical Podcast. Let's just put a little plug in there for it. Sorry, that was a cheap plug there. I really love this. It's so funny. Literally, when did I work this week? On Tuesday morning, and there's a stretch of that shift that I do, early morning shift, and we had full hospital and a tick patient that wasn't going that well. I had 16, no, I'm exaggerating, maybe 8 clients to call. And I know in the morning they want to get called. They want to know how the animal's doing. And then I had a not that sick consult come in, but they still want to be seen. And then I had a really sick one come in, like really dying and not obvious, like, oh shit, why are you dying? Sort of a thing. And total panic. You think that 20 years in, it wasn't any one thing that panicked me. Even that sick patient, my skill levels and my interest, that's where it is. I want to focus on that patient. But then my head goes, you've got to phone this person. You've got to do that. Phone's ringing, reception saying, have you phoned Ms. Smith yet with an update on? No, I haven't. And I just, it's exactly that moment of just going, everybody just piss off. And then those thoughts of, I hate this. I'm sorry, if my employer is listening, I don't really hate it at the time. I hate this. I don't want to work here anymore. I want to just go home.
But actually, you just hate the feeling.
Okay, so help me through that moment.
How did you get through that moment?
Head down and just keep plugging away one thing at a time. But and it's interesting you say this, the do what you say, not do what you do. Because I do try very hard. I do mindfulness practice. I do meditate because I do appreciate the, and sometimes it works, and I'll give examples of that. But I think the first thing, and tell me if I'm right, but is recognizing the emotion as an emotion, right? Not the truth.
That's correct.
So yeah. I had another one earlier in the week of a dog that was trying to bite me. You know, annoying thing. I'm in a hurry. I want to get home. I just needed a very simple thing, and this stupid bulldog's trying to bite me. And I was getting frustrated, and I actually had a rage. I was getting really, you know, when you start, and then I had a moment of mindfulness there, going, okay, I recognize it as anger. There's good reason for it, but just let it wash. Sit for a second and let that rage go, and then I can reset and start again and just do what I need to do. I was successful there. The other irritation of feeling overwhelmed and being cross with my boss because we are understaffed, but it's not really a fault, and being cross with the receptionist because they just booked in another thing and it's nobody's fault. I failed at that. I was grumpy about that the rest of the day. So how do I do that better? Or somebody who's still stuck in that, how do you get better at that?
The short answer is I probably don't know, but I think it's to do with the practice. So they talk about mindfulness being a practice because we never perfect it. Mm-hmm. And so the whole thing is about being aware. And the more you do it, the more you become aware. And in theory, I guess you become faster at picking up that emotion and trying to regulate it. And it's a deliberate choice here to say the word regulate and not control. So we're regulating our emotion so we can get through the job that we need to do. But it's hard. It's not straightforward. And a lot of these experts, you know, so it took them a good over 5 years of regular practice before they were able to make it a habit in their lives. So I'm a bit slow. I've probably been trying for longer than 5 years to make it a habit. I'm not quite there yet. I'm still probably using it as a reactionary tool. So I noticed that I'm feeling stressed and I'll use it at that moment, but I haven't become great at putting it into a habit as a preventative tool. But I think that's the key. The more we can use it proactively so that then in those moments you can catch yourself a little bit quicker. But I think that we need to go back and process that emotion at some point.
Mm-hmm. How?
Journaling, counselors, active reflection. I really like using a reflective sort of framework tool, and you can Google those and make a tool that works for you, where I just take the moment to say, okay, that was a bad day. You might look at that case and say, well, how was I feeling? What was happening around that time? And maybe it was that you hadn't had any sleep, or you were really hungry, or just the circumstances, and, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, what would you do differently, and maybe some action that you would take to make the situation better next time. And I found that being really, I don't do it. I always think I can do it more, but I definitely am getting better at using that when that sort of a process, when things haven't gone well. I think the pro level is when we start doing that, when things have actually gone well. So we can say, this was a good day. What made it a good day? So then we can start having more of them.
So is that what mindfulness means to you? Because it's such a thrown around junk word these days, mindfulness, which for some people I think brings to mind incense and bell-bottom pants. is that mindfulness for you? Is just being, yeah, well, tell me in your words, what does mindfulness mean for you? And then be, if you have a mindfulness practice, what does it look like?
Yeah, so mindfulness is just about being in the moment and just being present and not thinking about the future or thinking about the past. And I've been told for a long time, oh, you really should meditate. And I said, no, I can't do that. I don't know how to meditate. And I can imagine you might have thought the same thing, Hugh. And then until I found out what it actually was, and I went to a meditation sort of retreat or training thing, and learnt that it's not about turning your brain off. It's just about focusing on that here and now and that moment, and that having racing thoughts and that sort of stuff is quite normal. And it's about noticing it rather than trying to switch it off. You know, our brains, that's what they're designed for, to think. So we can't just say stop thinking. And I think that was a turning point for me when I realized that it's not, sitting in silence on the top of a mountain with incense going and having to be in the perfect place for it. I am a big fan of guided meditations, and that's probably because I get impatient and won't sort of sit there long enough, I think, if I just do it myself. But you can do all sorts of things. It doesn't have to be meditation. Like, people can do the mindful colouring or just random doodling. People that like the grounding and walking outside in their bare feet on the grass. But at the end of the day, anything that brings your focus on what you're doing. So all the people making sourdough in COVID were probably practicing mindfulness while they were kneading the dough.
I'm definitely on a journey with trying to figure this out. And I don't know. Some days I feel like I get worse in terms of mind going to a million places at once. I get worse the more I do it, but maybe not. I think it's just because I'm doing many different things that there's more that occupies my mind. And maybe without my mindfulness practice, I would have been a complete mess. So I don't know. It's very hard to monitor. And as a scientist, I want to track progress of some sort. And then the more I get into mindfulness practice and meditation, they go, no, that's not what it's about. It's not a competition. It's not about being a good meditator or achieving anything. It is just about it's about practice, like any activity that you do.
That just sounds like an absolutely perfect mindful moment you've just had there, Hugh. So you've been mindful, like being aware of that is mindfulness. That's all it is. It's being aware. So you've noticed that it might be that the more, since you've been doing your mindfulness practice, you're now able to notice those crazy thoughts and the racing mind and stuff like that. And now you keep practicing, you might start to notice the changes, or it's easier to slow it down.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe you're right. Maybe you, because you're so stuck in your head without mindfulness that you don't even realize what's happening. I have a way of thinking of it. When I started learning about meditation and started practicing a bit of meditation, I was trying to picture out of my head. I like visual thinking with anything vet related or anything, is what's the story about this thing I'm doing. As a surfer, I haven't surfed for ages. I like surfing, but in my head, so anybody who hasn't surfed, when you're beginning to surf, when you're learning to surf, the hardest bit is that impact zone between the beach and out the back where the waves are actually breaking, where you've got the foamy rollers and they'll just beat the crap out of you. You can't ride them. You can't do anything. It's just it's the impact zone, and they roll over you and you need to learn to duck dive. And that's really unpleasant. You've got salt in your nose and get rolled by the waves. But then through practicing that and paddling and paddling and paddling and getting fitter, getting better technique, you can get out to before the waves break. And those waves are still there. It's the same wave, but because you're further back and you're not just being rolled around by the waves, you just can sit and bob over the wave. The wave goes through you, under you, and it goes away. And then you can choose the one you want to ride. You can go, okay, I can let that one go. I can let that one go. Here's the one I want. Get on that and get the maximum impact. I don't know if it's a good description, but for me, that's what I try and achieve with mindfulness, is to get out of that impact zone of thoughts and emotions that you can't do anything because they just take you where they want you. Is to actually practice a little bit so I can get out back and sit back. That's the goal. Do I achieve it? Nah, not really. Mostly not.
Well, every time I think surfing is a great way to be mindful. I can't get myself over the fear of what might be under the water. maybe I haven't pushed myself through that impact zone because I just don't like getting dunked and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I think it's a really good metaphor that you've described, is that it's hard and it's not easy. Like, it seems like it should be easy, but it's not. And I think most people give up. They say, oh, I tried that once, didn't work. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's because it's not easy. Like, to sit there with your own thoughts and be still is really hard. And I think when we think it'll be a quick fix, and then it doesn't really work. And I think there's a lot of expectation that people who are practicing mindfulness or other well-being techniques are perfect at it, but we're human and so we do keep making mistakes, but we're becoming aware of what's happening. We can start trying to get better, I guess.
The most common reason, if you talk to somebody about meditation and they say, oh no, I can't meditate, my thoughts are everywhere, I can't sit still, and then in my head I'm like, yeah, that's exactly why you should learn to meditate. That's what it's a bit like saying, oh, no, I can't go for a run. I'm way too fat and unfit. Yeah, that's why you should start running.
Yeah, that's right. So you're asking about, you know, do we have proof that these sort of things work? And my understanding is that there's evidence from functional MRI machines of changes in people's brains after mindfulness training. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that, yeah, you're retraining a new neural pathway to break habits or create new positive habits. So there is evidence about it working.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of evidence out there. I think that's what got me into it, because I was very much put off by the incense and the woo-woo, and then actually seeing that, no, there's a lot of science behind it. This is what attracted me to it in the first place. So is this where, because when I researched you talk about neuroplasticity. It's one of your topics.
Yep.
Is that where that comes in? Is that about actually changing the structure of your brain?
Yeah, I think it was probably my aha moment was that, we often take on board a lot of negative feedback about ourselves or that we receive and think that that's the only way it can be and we're just sort of fixed that way. And learning that you can actually change those pathways then became kind of quite exciting. That's probably the vet in me going, oh, great, I can fix this. That's probably not the answer. It's not fixing, it's acceptance. But I guess that in itself is a new neural pathway, isn't it, where we retrain our brain not to berate ourselves but to have that acceptance and whatever, you know, just like teaching yourself a new habit. I think about it a bit like we know this, like we do it as vets with dogs, don't we? We do counter conditioning. We know that our dog reacts when it sees another dog. And if it sees the other dog 100 meters away, it doesn't react, but it sees it 50 meters away, it starts reacting. So we start training our dog to sit and be calm 100 meters away when it sees the other dog. And we give them lots of positive reinforcement with treats and things like that. We don't try and teach them when they're 50 meters away and they're already barking and their hackles are raised. So I think we intuitively know that this works.
So there's something that I sometimes wonder about. We'll take it back to that reaction I had in the emergency clinic the other day. Sometimes a part of me goes, all right, I've been doing this for 20 years. I still get that sort of reaction in those sort of situations. Maybe this is just the way I am. Maybe I'm not actually an emergency vet. Maybe I should do something that doesn't throw these situations at me because I still react like that. Is there, in the stuff that you're learning, because you talk about nature, I have a nature, I have a way of being, and even the personality styles and personality types, this is the way I am, versus growth mindset and neuroplasticity and saying, no, this is the way I am, but this is the way I would like to be. How much neuroplasticity is there? Is there that anchor core of who you are and how you like to react, or can you get over that completely?
I wish I knew the answer here, because I think I'm in exactly the same boat at the moment and I'm having exactly the same thoughts that you're describing, and it's really tricky. One of the things, so thinking about like where I have kind of come on this sort of well-being journeys, that I spent about 18 months teaching in schools locally about well-being and resilience. And one of the things we had was a neuroplasticity day where we spent a whole day teaching our year 7 kids about neuroplasticity. It was great fun, but there was another little sort of, I guess, aha moment of seeing some kids with some pretty traumatic backgrounds and just the look on their face when they learnt that their brain could change. Like they just, I don't know, that'll stay with me for a really long time. And I think it's probably because I'm trying to be kind to myself and think about that as well, that where we are the product of what has happened to us. And I think we have to believe that we can change it. So I don't know. It's Yeah, it's really, is it who we are? Are we accepted or and we can change it? Is it, does it have to be an or? Maybe it could be an and.
That's a great answer. I like that.
So I guess the thing comes back to, again, the do you want what you have or do you, are you doing the wrong thing? So maybe it is that, well, I want, what are the things about emergency medicine that you love? And if you don't want to feel like that doing it, then you have that internal motivation to try to do something about it.
That's gold. So we jumped in the deep end. Let's paddle back out to the shallow end for a little bit. Tell me about you a little bit. So you're obviously a veterinarian primarily. Tell me about your work history and how did you come to being interested in these things? How did it become your thing?
Yeah. Well, I grew up on a farm and went into vet because I wanted to live in the country and work with farmers, and I liked solving problems and seemed like a pretty good fit. And so I went through vet school with a fairly strong focus on farm animals. So I started my career in mixed practice and focused on dairy medicine, which was great. And then had a family and sort of fell into the stereotype of part-time small animal work. And after I had my second child, I took this practitioner in residence role at Melbourne Uni. And I thought, oh, I'll have a go at that, because I actually thought it was going to be that I was going to get an opportunity to upskill in my clinical skills. I was like, great, I'll go to the uni and I'll learn about, like, you know, I'll follow the specialists around and this will be a great continuing education. But it turned out to be a very different continuing education program. So it was more working with the students and really kind of coaching them around choosing and applying for jobs. And listening to them talk was really eye-opening, that they sort of said a lot of the things that resonated with me. You know, you could see their perfectionism and their fears and doubts. And I don't think anybody had really shown me that before. Like, I think role models made everything just look easy and really didn't talk about struggle. But the other part of it was that I was doing that job with Kathy Warburton from Make Headway, and she's introduced me to the concept of a growth mindset and neuroplasticity, and then I just kind of got hooked. So, yeah, I guess I went down this path. Yeah, I just was interested in it, and I guess when you're interested in things, you just keep researching them and learning more about them. And then, yeah, I was finding it really hard to really enjoy my work, and I saw this thing about how we can achieve more as vets, and I thought, oh, this will, I'll learn how to be a better vet. But turns out it was more about how to be a better human. But from that, I went and did some more study in the area and did a certificate in positive psychology. And then from that, I don't know, they talk about the connections that you meet in the course of your day. People who don't know your background will offer up different options and ideas because there's no preconceived idea. So just, you know, the people you meet at school pickup kind of thing that you talk to who have no idea. Somebody was working in this job in the school teaching wellbeing and resilience, and they knew that their team was expanding and that they were needing a sort of education support person. So I applied. And, yeah, so I did that and took a break out of general practice vet to do that, and then that's how I came to doing a little bit of emergency to try and pay the bills. I talked to myself about this job being paid work experience. That was good that it was. But yeah, so that meant I got to figure out how to teach and present, and then I just became addicted to these the looks on people's faces when they learnt these new ideas, and they're, I don't know, I guess that's why teachers become teachers, because they like that little moment where it clicks for the student, and it's kind of, yeah, so that's pretty addictive. So that's why I decided to start Flourish Ed, because I wanted to take what I learned from that school system into our world. I think that we can learn a lot from positive education and the things that they're teaching the kids that we kind of missed out on in our generation.
Quick interruption. Learning new skills, neuroplasticity, connections that open up new doors, being present and mindful in the moment. Those are all things that we'll be doing at the Vetveld Live in Noosa between 22 and 25 November later this year. We finalized our clinical program with the Oracles of Smallies Medicine, Professor Jill Madison and Professor David Church, just this week. Prof. Jill will be talking about clinical reasoning. So how our learning styles impact on our clinical decision-making and why we do what we do the way we do it. Plus taking us through some clinical conundrums with the jaundiced patient to help us cement the principles that we'll learn. While Prof. David will do what he does best with deep dives on Addison's, Cushing's, and diabetes and some case conundrums on the weak patient and the PUPD patient. But these are not just lectures. In fact, we are giving away 3 months of free access to our clinical podcasts to all the attendees, so you can listen to the episodes that we've already done with these two. And then we'll be doing what we do best, which is digging deeper through case discussions, Q&As, and more podcasting. I'm particularly looking forward to the recording we'll do on difficult diabetics on day two after our fancy pants lunch in our fancy pants Noosa restaurant that may or may not include some wines. Things might get a bit messy. Join us just for the two clinical days or join us for the full 4-day experience with hiking and kayaking and surfing and yoga and paddleboarding and exploring deeper living with Philip McKernan on day four. The link to the event is in the show description and you guys should use VV Listener. That's VV for VetVault Listener, all caps, at checkout to get your listener discount. Okay, back to Rebecca and teaching kids how to be more resilient.
I love that they teach kids this stuff these days. But a part of me is jealous. I see what my kids learn and I'm like, yeah, you guys have a head start. That's not fair.
I know. So then it's like, there may not be a role for this in 20 years, but yeah.
Yeah, well, we may not have to be retrospectively trying to patch holes in education or holes in upbringing. We might find that the vet in 20 years' time, this will be just natural to them.
But then we still need reminding. Like, I just don't think it comes that easily. It's lifelong learning. We just need to keep chipping away at it.
So what are the key things that you took from that, you know, those moments of insight that you saw on the kids' faces? Are there main things from that that you want to bring to the vet profession with Flourish Ed?
Yeah. So like I've sort of said, you know, a few things that a bit of a tagline being it's not just what we do, but how we do it. And what I mean by that is that I think there's an opportunity whenever we talk about wellbeing or any education, anything, that we can do it in a way that it actually increases our wellbeing while we're doing it. So because we have everyone's got a basic need to feel like they belong. If we can learn together as a group, it opens up that opportunity for building psychological safety. So some of the things that we would do with the teachers, trying to encourage them to have quick little games or activities in their sort of morning kind of roll call time. And look, I wouldn't say this was easy to get people on board with doing, but the idea was that play is when we kind of let our guard down a little bit and the kids could start to build stronger relationships with their teachers and their peers, because it's easier to feel like you belong when everyone's making a bit of a fool of themselves and you don't feel quite so self-conscious. So I think that type of those sorts of activities would be really helpful in veterinary teams to help build psychological safety between managers and teams. And that's priming our brain for having a better day. We're going to be more open-minded and we're going to be better able to solve problems or learn. We're going to have better relationships with other people when we've sort of primed our brain with some positive emotion. So one of the examples I would have would be one of the key parts of positive psychology that I've really loved is the idea of our strength, and so that we are looking at what is right about us and trying to reframe weaknesses as just maybe underplayed strengths. We've all got them. We can do this. It's not that you don't have this in you. And, you know, you could send out an email with a link to do a survey about what your strengths are and just go, there you go, great, you know what your strengths are. And that in itself will have a positive benefit to somebody if they do it. I think we sort of talked about the survey fatigue. People don't like surveys. Yeah. So we found it was more successful when we actually had it in a staff meeting. There was time set aside. You're all doing it. And we got the team to sort of have a guess at what their teammates' strengths might be. So it's called strength spotting. And again, the other moment was just standing back and watching these teachers run up to each other and go, hey, what did you get? I knew you'd have creativity. Oh, geez, I absolutely knew that you would be great at teamwork. And then that other person, you know, they've faced this, they feel great. They've just, you know, you've just got that moment of bonding, which they wouldn't have got if they'd been sitting in their office going, oh, I've got to do another survey. So So it's just getting extra bang for your buck and making it, yeah, really fun and deliberate.
So why is it important to find your strength? Why is that something that you're so interested in?
It's just been shown that when people are using their strengths at work or even just being aware of their strengths, and then even more so if they're using them, they're more likely to be engaged at work. They're more likely to be more productive, more efficient, more likely to get a sense of accomplishment and reach our goals if we're playing to our strengths. So the first step is becoming aware of what they are so that we can start to dial into them and use them to our advantage.
Yeah, I wonder, I feel like a lot of people, and I'll probably count myself in that group, don't really know what their strengths are. So, well, how did you find yours? I was going to say, how does one find yours? But how did you find your strengths?
I'm probably that one vet that does actually like filling out surveys. I like filling out a form. I get so excited when census comes around. I'm like, yes, it's a census year. So I just, I did the form. But that came through doing the wellbeing work, the courses in wellbeing that I've had and with the positive psychology. And there's a few different surveys you can do, but I'm a bit of a fan of the VIA Character Strengths Survey.
What's it called? And how do you spell that?
So VIA, which is the Values in Action Institute, founded by Martin Seligman and another guy, Chris Peterson. So they've sort of started the research in what are the strengths that are valued by people all around the world. And so they're basically a strength is a value in action. And there's 24 of them and we all have them, but the order that they're in is unique to us.
Okay.
So if you were to think about a time when you were doing really well, and it could be at work or in life, and things you felt really energized by what you were doing, can you think of a time like that? Something that you feel really energized by?
Well, the podcasts, I think it's the creative process of putting it all together. I'm in my that flow state when it's coming together, and I'm towards the end of saying there's a product that I really like. So that's definitely something. That's why I do it. Is I get that it's not stressful. I can just keep going at it. With clinical work, it is when the connections are good, and that's with clients or with coworkers. I love a team environment where the day is good and people are interacting nicely and you're having fun. Even if it's hard, it's still fun. That's what I thrive on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think I go to work to hang out with other people mostly.
I think we really are peas in a pod here, Hugh, because I was going to have a guess at what I thought your strengths might be or what you might say, and I was going to put money on it would be the podcast. And I mean, just so that you say you did identify the creativity of putting it all together, but I would have wondered whether it's that curiosity. Most of it, you know, we have bets, we're scientists, we're curious, and so you like to talk to people and find out about that. So I feel the same, and I do feel like, yeah, when it comes to the point with the vet work is that it's probably more about the people and hanging out with like-minded people, or when you have that connection and you're either learning together or you're wading through the mud together, it's quite, it's bonding. And one of the things that you can then do is use, if you're struggling in an area, potentially you can use one of your strengths to maybe help lift up the thing that you're struggling with. So again, if it's important, so if it's intrinsically important to you, you're talking about, go back to the stressful panic moment with the emergency. If that's important to you to be able to get through that, and maybe it might be important because that's, you know, bread and butter and the source of income and we need to feed our family, and then you might say, okay, well, I'm really curious, is one of my top strengths, or and I'm creative. You might start to think, well, I might use that curiosity to learn about what are all the strategies that can help me through that moment, and how can I creatively design something that's going to work for me? So instead of looking at it at that, oh, I don't know how, I can't do that, I'm not good at calming myself down, you can say, oh, hang on, what strengths do I have that can help me solve that problem?
I like that, because it's very easy to get, once you hit those negative emotions, to get stuck in a self-flagellation of going, ah, it's just typical of me. I'm so shit. I get so frustrated. Why can't I just be better at this, instead of doing that? Because once you get stuck in that thought pattern, it just perpetuates the situation. But I like that actually, to know your strengths and to go, well, okay, this is what's happening. Comes back to mindfulness, to going, all right, this thing that I do is happening. What tools have I got in my tool belt to make it better? That's really cool.
Yeah. And I think it's because we have a negativity bias, isn't it? So we tend to look at what's wrong with ourselves, and it's really, really hard to break that habit. And I think that's what I've found for me. That's the thing that's worked, is strengths. And I can try to go, okay, well, you know, I did a survey that's been validated by researchers or whatever. And so therefore I have these strengths. And I, you know, cynics can say maybe it's not, you know, you can't trust just a survey or whatever. But I do think the top ones don't tend to change very much, and we do tend to identify pretty strongly with them. And it just helps break that negative self-talk by saying, okay, well, even if I'm not really great at serenity and I'm not really good at feeling calm, or self-regulation is probably the one that we're sort of thinking about, controlling or managing our emotions in the moment. Not many Westerners are very good at that, if we're honest. But we can say, okay, it is a tough one to do. What are my top strengths that I can use to help me with that? I think it just switches our brain.
Are there things that people or that you misunderstood, or people commonly misunderstand about their strengths, or about strengths in general?
I think they misunderstand that they think that we're trying to ignore weaknesses, or that they're saying that if we only want to focus on strengths, that we don't want to talk about weaknesses. I think that's wrong. There's a lot of the emerging research is talking about overplayed and underplayed strengths, and finding the golden mean or the optimum use of our strengths. And so, yeah, it's not saying that there's not areas that we can improve. I think it's just framing it in a positive light, which is all that positive psychology is about, really, is focusing on the positives. It doesn't really serve anyone when we just keep focusing on the negatives. Like, it just, we spiral downwards in these spirals of negative emotion into these anxiety and depression, and that's not really that helpful. But focusing on the positive keeps us a little bit more open-minded and willing to engage in that process.
And it sounds so simple, but it's not. You said the word negativity bias, because sometimes when I was going to say people, but I could just say when you're grumpy or you have a negative emotion, it's kind of like we relish it, like we immerse ourselves in it. And even if somebody offers you that, you're stuck in this quagmire of negativity, and somebody throws you the life belt to try and get you out of it, it's almost like you push it away. It's like, no, I'm happy being angry. Just leave me alone. I'm pissed off. Don't try. My wife always says, don't play the glad game. So don't try and pretend things are fine when they're not.
Well, yeah, well, I do resonate with that. And that's where that neuroplasticity comes back in, isn't it? To say, okay, well, is this a habit that we need to change?
Yeah. Rebecca, can from looking at the work you do and the stuff you teach, something I've been wanting to talk about on the podcast for a while is difficult conversations. So you talk about when we're in situations at work that we don't like, the ones that we can do something about. And it's not just, well, I should reframe this. Here's a situation. I can actually fix it. If it is to do with people that you work with, and we often focus on our interactions with clients and negative interactions there, but a lot of it comes down to team as well. Like, nobody's more unhappy as a vet who's in a team that they don't gel with, and there's inter-team conflict and problems and little annoyances and things like that. With your teaching, do you cover having difficult conversations at all? Having a good way of going up to a colleague or a boss, or boss going to an employee to talk about something that's not easy to talk about?
Yeah. Well, you know, the saying, you teach what you most need to learn. I'm totally putting it out there that this is my big blind spot and an area that I really, really struggle with. But one of the things that I love teaching primary school kids that I think we could all learn from is what I call the superhero conversation. So we talk a lot about using I statements. Turns out I'm quite good at teaching my son how to have these conversations. So he's also called Hugh, by the way.
No way.
So Hugh is great at superhero conversations. And my husband and I just sit there kind of in awe. We just say, wow, how do you do that? You know, you can see he's upset about something and he's really trying to bottle it all up and eventually kind of get out. Okay, there is something troubling you. And so we say, okay, well, we need to have a superhero conversation. So we practice it and it sort of starts with, I noticed, and then he'll say what happened. And this made me feel. And then you should sort of have a request of what you'd like to change or to have happen. But I think I get stuck very much in that bubble of tension of like, okay, I know I need to have this conversation and I can script it in my head or write it down, but then that taking that next step and having the conversation is really hard. And I think that comes back to getting a lot of negative feedback for when things haven't gone well, so that you then become so anxious about stuffing it up again that then it's going to snowball into an even bigger conflict, which, you know, you're talking about driving through the, what do you call it, the impact zone in the surf. Unfortunately, that's the only way through it, is to go through that discomfort. And I'm trying to train my brain to do that better by trying to relearn that and trying to test that in areas where I feel safe, I guess is the key, feeling that you're safe to have that, try that difficult conversation.
I like this, the term superhero conversation, because yep. it's courageous action. It is, especially for, I think the data says that as a profession, we are to a very large extent one of the amiable social style. I mean, we like getting along with people. I think Gerardo always talks about 70%. He does a talk about social styles, and when they do them at talks, almost always about 70% of the people in the audience, in a veteran audience, are amiable. So don't like conflict, just want to get along with everybody. And I think it's a trap, because then when you let these little things build up, that you go, oh, it's just a small annoyance, I'm not going to upset the person by talking about this little thing that annoys me, but then it keeps annoying you. It keeps annoying you, and it builds into a resentment. I know I read a beautiful simile for this, to say it's like the snake under the carpet. It's under the carpet. You can't see it. It's there. But if you ignore it long enough, it turns into a dragon. And when it's big enough, it's going to devour you. And then you can't do anything about it. Whereas if you just went to deal with it when it was a small little snake, you could actually deal with it. Would you classify yourself as one of those amiables who rather avoid conflict than have the superhero conversation?
Yeah, I feel like I'm surprised that there's 30% of people that aren't that way.
Oh no, I've worked with all of them.
I definitely avoid it. And I guess this is part of my learning, is watching Hugh have these conversations, and I'll say to him the next day, oh, did you have that conversation? And he says, oh yeah. And I'm like, oh, how did it go? And he just had one this week where, and he said, oh yeah, so my friend just said, oh, that's okay, I can just see that was a misunderstanding.
Wow, that's, how old are these guys?
Oh, like 9.
That's spectacular. Wow.
I know, that doesn't seem to be what happens when we try to do it in our workplace as adults. Don't seem to be able to like forgive and forget or move on. It's just, I don't know. As I said, like I people who know me who are listening to this are just going to be like, oh my God, Vex, you're a hypocrite. But yeah, I think I want to be vulnerable to say this is hard. And to bring it back to the why I think it's so important to have these fun, positive emotion generating activities as a team, is because that's how we build that psychological safety where we feel like we can have those conversations. Because it's so when you do a silly game where it's really hard and everyone sort of mucks it up and you can't really, like, it's a challenge that nobody can really reach, then everyone's looking silly, everyone starts laughing, and it just breaks all those barriers down. And so I think that helps make it easier to try and deal with the snake rather than waiting till it's a dragon.
Maybe that's why vets like getting drunk together. To the leveler.
Yeah, so we want to do that without the alcohol and within work hours. So, you know, yeah. But I think that's right. It's exactly, you know, when we make fools of ourselves, we come together. I just think it's important to try to make time to do that.
Okay, so the goal is to have a workplace where it shouldn't be that hard to have superhero conversations where that's the norm and where it's okay because you know that the person's not going to sulk for the next month because you actually said that I don't like it when you do X, Y, and Z. Coffee cups, or, when you don't wash your coffee cup.
Oh, God. Is that a universal vet clinic problem? The coffee cup wars. Yeah. Don't worry. I've walked into that one before. Yeah. But I think, like, for me, one of the barriers I have is feeling safe that to practice it. So I know that the first few times I try and have a superhero conversation, it's not going to work. Like, it's I'm going to stuff it up. I'll do it wrong. And I don't always feel safe to make those mistakes. And I guess that comes back to our feedback and using strengths that we're sort of trying to keep it positive rather than, oh my God, you're terrible at conflict management, or, you know, you can't have courageous conversations. You don't have anywhere to go from that. You're just sort of going to retreat into your shell where you can sort of say, hey, I really loved how you dialed up your bravery and you had a go. That was a really great first step. I know how hard it is to start those conversations, and that was really hard. Sounds like it didn't really go all that well, or, you know, you could have done something different. How would we approach it next time?
Mm-hmm. You talk about one of your talks at the Vet Expo is about the positive work review, like the performance mm-hmm. review.
Yep.
This sort of slots into that. How do we have those? Because it's the same thing, isn't it? It's sometimes there has to be some superhero conversations in that.
Yeah, so that's exactly it. So using the strengths in that superhero conversation. I think for me, a lot of the positive feedback I get might be quite brief or limited. So I don't think we've got a very good language. We say, oh, you're a good vet. Well, what does that mean? I don't know how to repeat being a good vet. You know, I think there's a lot of talk in leadership management stuff about specific feedback. It's just another language for giving that specific feedback. I mean, none of the strengths words are weird. Like, it's just the normal words, and it does seem like common sense, and it doesn't seem all that difficult, but yeah, we just don't do it. This just gives us a bit of a language to address the positives. So you might, yeah, instead of just saying you're a good vet, it might be that I love how you're curious and you look things up and you go and you sign up to the continuing education things, or that I love how, you know, you're honest and you do tell us when things aren't working or you made a mistake, things like that. I think when we have those more specific words, we have a new language that helps people repeat those positive behaviors. It's just like anatomy was really hard to learn, and we were a bit clunky using all those words, cranial and caudal, and then they just became natural. And so it's just the more that we can use those words, I think, helps people really internalize the things that they do that are right about themselves, so they're not, like you're saying, going to this beating yourself up and all these negative thought patterns.
Mm. So is the work review, is that a place to talk about the negative things as well?
Yeah, I just think we can talk about the negative things but use this positive language when we're doing it.
I'm always so wary, though, with these things. When I had a team that I actually had to give feedback to, of the shit sandwich. Because, it's a bunch of smart people. If you're trying to dress up negative feedback in a compliment or buried in a shit sandwich, does it work? It doesn't really work. I feel like people don't take it on. They're like, I see what you're doing. You're trying to trick me with your positivity, and actually you should just come out and say what you want to say.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that, because you're not the, I feel like that was verbatim what another practice manager has said to me in the past too. As I'm a big fan of the shit sandwich. I think it's great. We all have different needs when it comes to feedback. And so I've actually been curious about what works for different people. So the shit sandwich might not work for you, but it does work for me. And so if we assume a one-size-fits-all model for everybody, then I think we kind of exclude people with different needs. And I think if we can start to be a bit more open-minded and actually ask people, how do you want feedback? Do you want it regularly? Do you want to ask for it? Do you want me to come to you with it? Do you only want to hear about bad things? You know, we can tailor it to different people's needs. But I think when we assume that everybody just wants it one way, we risk sort of really compromising some diversity and inclusion in our industry.
Yeah, that's the art of being a good leader, isn't it? It's trying to figure out these nuances of how to do these things.
Mm.
Well, if we create the work environment where superhero conversations are commonplace and there is that psychological safety, then really when it comes to the performance review or whatever you want to call it, there shouldn't be the need for negative feedback because you've said it already. Because what often happens in your average vet practice with a normal human being who is the leader, who doesn't have superhero leadership skills, is they'll hold all those little problems throughout the year. And then it's the annual review or something. And then it'll be, you're a very good vet. I like how you communicate, but X, Y, Z, 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 Z. And it's an overwhelm of, here's all the shit things you do, which makes you feel undervalued and like, oh, what? I waited a year to hear you tell me all these little things that I should be doing better. Rather, if there's that psychological safety where the feedback comes all day and there's those little minor adjustments, you address the little snakes under the rug before they become dragons, way better scenario than trying to sit in that annual meeting. The annual meeting should just be, okay, where are we heading? Where do you want to be with your career in a year from now? Or how do you feel you've done? We had a talk about this thing 6 months ago, how are we doing? Rather than dumping all of those things in one go, which is unfortunately what often happens.
Yeah, and I think then it goes down to your frequency and do you have a structure around when you give all those other little feedbacks to avoid it all building up? I don't know. I'm a big fan. I'm a planner. I think that if we don't make time for it, then there'll be no time for it. I mean, who's seen a quiet moment in a vet practice in the last 2 years? Like, we wait for a quiet day to talk about something that won't happen. And I guess, again, using those strengths, you can use those words in that. I think the idea of overplaying or underplaying a strength, I don't know, for me that sounds way less confronting than just pointing out the bad behaviors. It just seems to come across, I don't know, I think it just softens it a little bit.
Yeah. Cool. So talking of masterful leaders, I Googled you. I looked at your profiles. I saw a comment about Ted Lasso, the best leader in the world.
Yeah.
What did you, so anybody who doesn't know, if you don't have Apple Plus, Apple TV Plus, there's a series on there called Ted Lasso about an American football coach who goes to coach soccer or football in the UK and watching him walk into a toxic culture and turning it around or working within it, slowly working on it. It's a beautiful series. And I watched it and every episode I was like, this, there's a leadership lesson. This is how you lead a team. Did you have any, did you watch it just for the pleasure or did anything that you watched there sink in for you and you go, ah, I want to do that more. I want to see more of that at my workplace or I want to be more of that at my workplace.
Yeah. So I am probably one of the few people I think in the world that doesn't have a Netflix account and got Apple Plus free.
You and me.
Oh, really? Oh, great. Good. I'm not the only one. Yes. So when I upgraded my phone or iPad or something, got the free subscription. And anyway, my husband got into it. And I have this about, is it Ted Lasso or Ted Lasso? I don't know. But we loved it because he's into sports. So he was just like, great, this is a show about soccer. And then my sister-in-law, who's a pretty good leader, has a pretty important job, she was all excited raving about it. And I was just like, oh, she likes it. Maybe I'll like it. So I started watching it. And then my husband was just like, I don't think you'd get into this. Like, this is a sports show. And I'm like, this is not a sports show.
It's not a show about sport at all. It's a show about relationships, about vulnerability, about leadership.
Yep. So I loved it. So I said, wow, Apple have created like the perfect show that both the sports mad husband and the like, you know, weird positive psychology interested wife can enjoy together. And guess what? That means we bond and we get some positive emotion, right?
Yeah.
But the thing that I took out of it the most, I think, is the idea. I mean, so the other part of the event is that Ted has no idea about what soccer is. So he's come from America coaching American football to come and teach to coach soccer. And, you know, he's really successful at it. And it just shows us that we don't have to be the best on field to be the best leader or to have something to contribute. My husband did research it a little bit, but I think his character might be based on this Italian coach manager, Arrigo Sacchi. And so my husband gave me this quote, I'll credit him here. So you don't have to have been a horse to be a jockey is apparently what he said. And so he was a shoe salesman that actually coached an Italian soccer team to like World Cup Premiership and took them from sort of nothing. So he had no, he didn't know how to play soccer. And I think My observation has been traditionally in our industry that the best vet in terms of their clinical skills is who ends up being the boss or in charge. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that whether that necessarily means that that's the best, they've got the best people skills or the best way to coach and grow people. And can we, again, go back to playing to people's strengths and thinking about how they can contribute? We've all got different things to contribute to the team and to the leadership. So I think Ted shows us that you don't have to be the being a horse to be the jockey.
I like that. All right, so we talked about TV, podcasts. Mm-hmm. Do you listen to podcasts?
I do when I have time, when I'm in the car. So that's, yeah, I drive a long way to do emergency work because I get 2 hours in the car with my children listening to whatever I want.
So favorites?
I'm too curious and I have too many. But one of the ones that I probably listen to a lot is How to Be Awesome at Your Job. So I think that's showing you how much I worry about all my failings and I've definitely got plenty to grow. Mm-hmm. But if I ever feel like a bit of a laugh or feel like, you know, just sort of switch off from that learning is I like Chat 10 Looks 3 with Annabelle Crabb and Lee Sales, and they talk about books and shows that they've been watching. And it's just their relationship is just so natural and fun as friends that you kind of feel like you're sitting in their living room with them, and makes me just wish that I could be like praying for them to be invite me to their party or something. You want to sit next to them on a plate or, you know.
What was that one called again? I missed the name of the of that
Chat
one.
10 Looks 3.
Chat 10
yep.
Looks 3.
There's a reason behind the name, but I've forgotten what it was. But yeah.
Okay. I'm going to have to look that up. Okay, your last question. You are doing a talk soon, but let's say you have an opportunity to do a talk to all the veterinary new grads of the world all in one go. You've got just a couple of minutes. What's going to be your one message?
Listen to your gut and trust it. If something doesn't feel right, it probably isn't. And I think they can apply that to trying to find their first job. We know how important it is that new grads start off well. So I think if things don't feel right, listen to that. And the same with, yeah, I find that often, nearly always when I'm not sure what to do clinically or in any job I've done, is that like what my gut was telling me ends up being what was right. I sort of just should have just listened to it in the first place.
So were you earlier in your career, were you not that good at listening to your gut and your head led you to the wrong places?
Oh, I'm still not good at listening to my gut. No, I've definitely not been good at it, but I'm probably more aware of it now. So there you go. I'm mindful of it, and I'm probably working towards getting closer to acting on it sooner.
It's a hard one for us because, again, we are very head trained that our heads are the things to follow. And then we're very cerebral in the work that we do. So gut following does not come naturally to us. So, challenge out there for our listeners. Big. That was really epic. That was really lovely. Thank you so much for giving us your time and sharing your wisdom, and for the bigger work that you're doing, for being brave enough to take it on and to try and make all these positive changes in a profession that definitely needs it.